You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show.
I was walking on a university campus the other day, and I will not name which one, but I saw a bunch of students waving the hammer and sickle, the blood red flag of the former Soviet Union. And I walked over and I said, what are you protesting? I said, we're protesting capitalism, an evil system that oppresses people. I said, well, what system are you promoting? We're promoting a collectivist communist system where people are equal and everyone is equal rights and everyone is prosperous. I said, well, what are the main points of the Communist Manifesto, which has delimited these ideas, and they couldn't tell me. And then I walked a little further, and there was another group protesting the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, and I asked, and they were chanting, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. And I asked, which river? Which sea? And they couldn't answer me. So I see there seems to be a major problem of lack of education here about these ideas. And contrary to what many people believe, ideas are powerful. Ideas can change the world. And so I thought we would look a little bit more in depth at some of these ideas that modern students are embracing and see what happens when you test them with the power of human reason. And for this exercise, I'm looking at a book called The Law and the Clichés of Socialism, a book that was written back in the 60s by the Constructive Action Incorporated, a nonprofit group that examines ideas in great depth and then writes about them. Now, the reason we're looking at this is because the same ideas that were examined in France in 1848... the same socialist communist ideas that were used to found the Soviet Union and China, and communist China, are now sweeping North America. We see the election of a democratic socialist mayor in New York, and we see openly communist and socialist politicians being elected to Washington and to the government in Ottawa. And so it would be very important to examine some of these ideas in depth and see if they stack up to what the claims that are made for them. So we're going to be looking at the clichés of socialism. And this book is a collection of suggested answers to some of the most common arguments that are used in favor of democratic socialism today. Failure to answer these questions has effectively silenced many a spokesperson for freedom. So the book is called The Law and the Clichés of Socialism, and they're going to look at about 42 of these clichés and see a rebuttal made by free enterprise individuals to each of these clichés. Now, I want to stress that what we are discussing today is not necessarily my ideas, and it's not the certainly not the ideas of this radio station. So they are the ideas of the individual authors who contributed to this book, and so I want to make that very clear that these are the ideas of the authors and not necessarily of the radio station or of myself. So cliche number one, the more complex the society, the more government control we need. Argued a college president at a recent seminar, quote, your free market, private property, limited government theories were all right under the simple conditions of a century or more ago, but surely they are unworkable in today's complex economies. The more complex the society, the greater is the need for government control. That seems axiomatic, unquote. It is important to expose this often heard, plausible, and influential fallacy because it leads directly and logically to socialistic planning. This is how a member of the seminar team answered the college president. Quote, let us take the simplest possible situation, just you and me. Next, let us assume that I am as wise as any president of the United States who has held office in your lifetime. With these qualifications in mind, do you honestly think that I would be competent to coercively control what you shall invent, discover, create, what the hours of your labor shall be, what the wage you shall receive, what and with whom you shall associate and make voluntary exchange? Is not my incompetence demonstrably apparent in this simple of all societies? Now, let us shift from this simple situation to a more complex society, to all the people in this room. What do you think of my competence to coercively control their creative actions? Or let us contemplate a really complex situation. The 300 or so million people of the United States and the 40 million people of Canada. If I were to suggest that I should take over the management and the micromanagement of their lives and their billions of exchanges, you would think me the victim of hallucinations. Is it not obvious that the more complex the economy, the more certainty will government control of productive effort exert a retarding rather than an enhancing influence on the nation? Obviously, the more complex our economy, the more we should rely on the miraculous self-adapting process of men and women acting freely. No mind of man, nor any combination of minds, can even envision, let alone intelligently control, the countless human energy exchanges in a simple society, to say nothing of a complex one. It is unlikely that that college president will raise that question again. While exposing fallacies can be likened to beating out bush fires endlessly, the exercise is nonetheless self-improving as well as useful, in the sense that rear guard actions are useful. Further, one's ability to expose fallacies, a negative tactic, appears to be a necessary preface to influentially accenting the positive. Unless a person can demonstrate competence at exploding socialistic error, he is not likely to gain wide audiences for his views about the wonders wrought by men and women who are totally free. Of all the errors heard around the bargaining tables or in modern university classrooms, there is not one that cannot be explained away. We only need to put our minds to it. In this work, we seek to help those who would expose fallacies and accent the merits of freedom. The more who outdo us in rendering this kind of help, the better. And the author of this was Leonard E. Reed. Cliche number two. If we had no Social Security, people would all go hungry. Through compulsory Social Security has been a law of the land for but little more than two generations. Many citizens of the United States and also of Canada are now convinced that they wouldn't get along without it. To express doubts about the propriety of the program is to invite the question, would you let people starve? Millions of Canadians and Americans are old enough to remember things that happened prior to the passage of the Social Security Act in 1935 and equivalent legislation in Canada. But where is the one of them who ever watched human beings starve? No modern capitalist nation has ever had a famine. Many other nations have, however. No, we wouldn't let them starve. Anyone would have to work hard at it in secret to approach starvation in this country and other free enterprise countries. So why is it so widely believed that without Social Security payment benefits, many people would go hungry? The Social Security idea is based on the questionable premise that a man's usefulness ends at the age of 65. He is supposed to be without savings and without capacity to continue to earn a living. If that premise were correct, it would be easy to see how hunger might develop among the aged. If they are really good for nothing, who wants to be bothered to look after old folks? Lumping people into groups and jumping to conclusions about each group, people over 65 would go hungry without Social Security, is standard socialistic procedure. A corollary socialistic conclusion is that breadwinners under 65 must be compelled by force of law to respect and care for their elders. These conclusions rest on false assumptions made by those so lacking in self-respect that they can have no faith in anyone else as an individual. Their faith is in force, the force of government and the force of law, coercion, and they conclude that government holds the only answer to every problem. To those of little faith, it is necessary to explain again and again and again that government is non-creative and can only distribute only what it first taxes away from the productive efforts of individuals. The people are first, last, and always individuals. Some are more economically creative than others, but each is worthy of respect as a human being. To tax a person's earnings and savings for other than defensive purposes is to reduce his capacity and his incentive to care for himself and for others, rendering him part slave to others, and thus less than human. Furthermore, he is also enslaved and debased, who either volunteers or is forced to look to the taxing power of government for his livelihood. Slavery, unfortunately, has been tried in the United States and Canada. Unfortunately, and the major reason that it failed is that it was and is a highly unproductive way of life, let alone the moral aspects of it. It lets people go hungry. It also is morally degrading to both the slave and the master alike. Yet, we are being told that without compulsory Social Security taxes upon the young and the strong, the oldsters among us would go hungry, perhaps starve. We are invited to try once again a semi-slave system under benevolent masters, of course. Well, those socialists are dead wrong. Their premises are faulty. Free human beings may be counted upon to care well for themselves and for their fellow men and women, voluntarily. What should concern us all is that if we persist under the false premises of the Social Security idea, socialism, in other words, many Americans and Canadians will go hungry, not only physically hungry, but morally and spiritually starved as well. The prime argument against Social Security is in the moral realm. Giving to one individual or group the fruits of the labor of others taken from them by coercion is an immoral procedure with destructive effects upon the sense of personal responsibility of everyone involved. But there are sufficient reasons for rejecting the program, even from a strictly materialistic point of view. Number one, it is not old age insurance. It is a regressive income tax, the greatest burden of which falls upon those earning a certain amount or less annually. The so-called Social Security fund of now several trillion dollars amounts to nothing than a bookkeeping entry, showing how much money the federal government has borrowed from itself in the name of Social Security and spent on other purposes. In fact, the fact that an individual has paid Social Security taxes all their lives does not mean that any of that money has been set aside or invested for his or her account. If he or she ever receives Social Security benefits, it must come from taxes collected from others. At the same time, the matching amounts presumably paid by employers on behalf of individual employees are in effect paid by the employees either through reduced wages or through higher prices for goods and services paid for by other citizens. Offering a subsidy to those who retire at age 65 does not provide additional savings for plants and tools and thus create jobs for younger workers. It simply increases their tax load. A person now entering the Social Security program at age 20 is scheduled to pay $1.69 in taxes for every $1 promised in benefits, a very poor investment indeed. The author of this was Paul L. Poirot.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book The Law and the Clichés of Socialism, and this is published by the Constructive Action Group, Incorporated. And I want to stress again that the ideas presented in this show are not necessarily my ideas and not necessarily the ideas of this radio station, and are the ideas of the individual authors involved, whose names will be cited after each of the clichés. Cliché number four, the right to strike is conceded, but rarely challenged is the right to strike. While nearly everyone in the population, including the strikers themselves, will acknowledge the inconvenience and dangers of strikes, few will question the right to strike concept. They will instead place the blame on the abuses of this assumed right. For instance, on the bungling or ignorance or evil of the men and women who exercise the control of strikes. The present laws of the United States and Canada recognize the right to strike. It is legal to strike. However, as in the case of many other legal actions, it is impossible to find moral sanctions for strikes in any credible ethical or moral code. This is not and let me repeat, not to question the moral right of a worker to quit their job or the right of any number of workers to quit in unison. Quitting is not striking, unless force or the threat of force is used to keep others from filling the jobs that have been recently vacated. The essence of the strike, then, is the resort to coercion to force unwilling exchange or to inhibit willing exchange. No person, nor any combination of persons, has the moral right to force themselves at their price on any employer or to forcibly preclude his hiring of others. Reference need not be confined to moral and ethical codes to support the conclusion that there is no moral right to strike. Nearly everyone's sense of justice will render the same verdict if an employer-employee relationship devoid of emotional background be examined. Quote, an individual with an ailment employs a physician to heal him. The physician has a job on agreeable terms. Our sense of justice suggests that either the patient or the physician is morally warranted in quitting his employer-employee relationship at will, provided that there is no violation of the contract. Now assume that the physician, the employee, goes on strike. His ultimatum, quote, you pay me twice the fee I am now getting or I quit. Moreover, I shall use force to prevent any other physician from attending to your ailment. Meet my demands or do without medical care from now on. Unquote. Who rightfully will claim that the physician is within his or her moral rights when taking an action such as this? The above, be it noted, is not mere analogy, but a homology, an accurate matching and structure of the common or garden variety of legalized, popularly approved strikes. To say that one believes in the right to strike is comparable to saying that one endorses monopoly power to exclude business competitors. It is saying, in effect, that government-like control is preferable to voluntary exchange between buyers and sellers, each of whom is free to accept or reject the other's best offer. In other words, to sanction a right to strike is to declare that might makes right, which is to reject the only foundation on which civilization can stand. Lying deep at the root of the strike, the persistent notion that an employee has the right to continue an engagement once he has begun it, as if the engagement were his own personal piece of property. The notion is readily exposed as false when examined in the patient-physician relationship that we've already discussed. A job is but an exchange affair, having existence only during the life of that exchange. It ceases to exist the moment either party quits or the contract ends. The right to a job that has been quit is no more valid than the right to a job that has never been held. The inconvenience of individuals and the dangers to the economy inherent in strikes should not be blamed on the bungling or ignorance or evil of the men who manipulated them. Rather, the censor should be directed at the false idea that there is a moral right to strike. The author of this work was Leonard E. Reed. Cliché number 5. Too much government. Just what would you cut out? This familiar question raised by those who are uncritical of government-guaranteed welfare, security, and prosperity has baffled many a student of libertarian ideas, often leaving him or her speechless and humiliated. As well as it might, for any individual would find it virtually impossible even to list the multitudinous activities of the federal government, not to mention those of the 50 state governments and the 10 provincial governments in Canada, and the more than 500,000 regional, district, and local governments. Certainly no audience, much less the questioner, would wait for a discussion of these manifold activities. The immensity of such a task is reflected in this fact. To give 1 hour's consideration to each $1 million of the 1960 federal budget alone would consume all of a person's working time, working steadily until the year 2000. Even if such a chore could be completed, the real question would still remain, just what would you cut out? However, if the principles of limited government were understood and accepted, then by definition all activities not qualifying would be eliminated. The limited government concept can be stated as follows. Quote, government should defend the lives and property of all citizens equally. This means protecting willing exchange and restraining unwilling exchange, suppressing and penalizing fraud, misrepresentation, predatory practices, invoking a common justice under written law, and keeping the records incidental to these functions. Government's legitimate purpose is to codify and then inhibit all destructive actions, while leaving all creative and productive actions, including welfare, charity, security, and prosperity, to citizens acting voluntarily, privately, cooperatively, or competitively as they freely choose. In the United States, the concept of government is outlined in the Declaration of Independence, and that holds that man is endowed by his Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Thus endowed with freedom of choice, each individual is presumed responsible for their own life and the development of their potentialities, within the limits of non-interference with the equal rights of every other peaceful person. Personal accountability further assumes responsibility for the products of one's creative efforts, the means by which life is sustained, and establishes a basis for the private ownership and control of property. Consistent with the ideals of self-responsibility, personal freedom of choice, and private property, is the free market method of voluntary exchange whereby individuals help themselves through serving others. Possessing economic freedom, each person may practice compassion and charity, which is what his is own. This leaves to government, which is organized force, the very limited task of defending life and property and preserving the peace. Once the basis for limited government is accepted, it is possible for a person to test any present activity of government at whatever level by a precise standard which tells him or her whether that activity is a proper function of an organized police force. It is a matter of reasoning logically and deductively from our Declaration of Independence, the premise that man's right to life and liberty is derived not from the state, but from another source, named in the document as his Creator. The author here was Leonard E. Reed. We'll continue looking at these cliches in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio Simon Fraser 90.1 FM.